children aged 12 to 15 are now eligible to receive a key COVID-19 vaccine. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, everything you need to know about the COVID shot for your kids. Do you plan on vaccinating your children? Maybe you don't want to. Either way, give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, some positive news for your week in our What's Good Wednesdays. First, though, here's your COVID update for the day. An increase in cases from Monday in Florida of COVID. The number is 3,263 and 48 new deaths. The death toll in the state from the virus stands at 35,831. So what we continue to see is just a slow burn of cases and deaths. It hasn't gone away yet, folks. So please get your vaccine and please make sure to mask up when you go into crowded indoor spaces. Now, amidst these numbers, a big announcement this week from Pfizer. Their COVID vaccine is now available for children aged 12 to 15. Mobeen Rathore, MD, is professor of pediatrics, associate chair and chief infectious diseases at the University of Florida College of Medicine, Jacksonville, and he is on the line now. Dr. Rathore, always good to have you on the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And as we talk about the COVID vaccine for kids, give us a call with your questions, thoughts, concerns. Will you vaccinate your child or not? It's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax. And our Facebook page is open. So, Dr. Rathore, you've hailed this as very good news. Tell us a little bit more about the Pfizer shot now approved for children and the process that led to that.
Well, I think this is really great news for children because, as you know, almost 4 million children have been reported to be infected with this virus and from the beginning of the pandemic. And children have really suffered in many numerous other ways, which includes disruption of their education, harms to their mental and emotional health, and also delays in getting health care, including much-needed vaccination. So vaccinating children will protect their health and will allow them to really fully engage in all the activities that are really so important for their health and development. So this was good news. It is a significant step in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. This allows us for our younger population to be protected against COVID-19 and begin to get us closer to returning some sense of, you know, what it used to be, what normal life used to be in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and hopefully ending the pandemic. So I think this is terrific news, and I think we need to continue our efforts today, this afternoon. I'm confident, almost certain, that there will be unanimous decision by the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices to immunize our children, because I think everybody realized children are about 80 million. There are about 80 million children less than 19 years of age in the United States, which is about 29%. And we are never going to get to that herd immunity if these children are not part of the immunization effort.
Absolutely. I mean, they are like more likely to carry the disease than get sick themselves. That said, there are children who have gotten sick and died from the virus.
You're absolutely correct. You know, fewer children than adults actually have suffered the most severe disease. But this is not a benign disease in children. I think this is something we need to keep always in mind. There are thousands of children who have been hospitalized and hundreds have died of this disease. That often gets unnoticed. And the good news is we'll soon have a very safe, highly effective vaccine that can prevent so much of this suffering. And I encourage all parents to talk to their pediatricians about how to get the vaccine for their children. And as soon as they become eligible, that conversation needs to start now. So I think not as sick, but they can shed the virus for much longer. And remember, they can then expose the grandma or the aunt or uncle or whoever who may be elderly or may have an underlying health disease and can give them the infection. And they, especially if they're not immunized, can have serious illness, which they could even die from.
We'll go to your calls in a moment for Dr. Mobeen Rathore of UF College of Medicine in Jacksonville about the COVID vaccine for kids age 12 to 15 now available. It's 549-2937. You know, there are children who are known as COVID long haulers, Dr. Rethor, and there's anecdotal evidence to show that when people with long COVID get the vaccine, they improve. Is this something that you think might happen with some children?
Yeah, that part has to be studied more, and we need more information on that because, you know, this is a prevention vaccine and not a treatment vaccine. So we really need to make sure that we get the vaccine so people don't get this long-haul disease. I think there's another part to it which is critically important for children. For somebody who's 60, 65 years of age, if they get COVID vaccine, COVID disease, and they recover, so they may have 15, 20 more years to deal with it and may not necessarily face the full brunt of it. On the other hand, a child may have 60, 70, 80 years to live after they get the infection, and they can certainly have a lot more complications of the disease that we don't even know yet. And we are learning a lot about it. It's not just the long COVID. It's how it affects your heart, the effects of brain, you know, the fogginess that people are reporting. We are going to learn a lot more about it. And I think if we can prevent this disease, and then I think we'll help our children in the long run also. But don't forget, if you recall, you know, children, the individuals who got polio as children and recovered, in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, they had the post-polio syndrome, and they had a whole set of different complications. So I think if you get the disease, you know, you may recover from it then, but down the road, you may have some serious problems.
Now, all three makers of the U.S. authorized vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, they are looking at studying the safety and effectiveness of their vaccines in even younger children, even as young as 6 months. At what point do you think that they will approve this vaccine for even kids younger than 12?
Right. So I think currently the Pfizer is the only vaccine that is approved for 12 years of and older children. But I suspect that other vaccines will soon follow and get approval. Pfizer already actually has the data for 2 to 11-year-olds, and they will be filing, I hear, in September. I hope sooner than that, so many of these kids can get the vaccine before school starts, so they can be protected through the school. But I think once you get that vaccine by the end of this, by the fall, we will then have the opportunity to immunize those kids while the studies are ongoing for the 6 months to 2-year-olds. And I suspect probably in winter sometimes or late fall, we may see some results that may be submitted to the FDA for approval. So by the end of this year, I would hope that with Pfizer vaccine, everybody 6 months and older would be eligible. And I think on the heels of that, you'll see Moderna and J&J have their vaccines become available in a very similar manner, first for 12 to 18, just as we see with Pfizer vaccine.
And what would you say, Dr. Rethor, to parents out there who are hesitant to vaccinate their children?
Well, as a pediatrician, I want all children and teens in my practice and everywhere to have the protection of this vaccine, because I know this vaccine really does have the power to prevent them from suffering if they are exposed to the virus. And as a parent or as an uncle, I am also making sure that all children and teens in my own family are vaccinated. I mean, I'd encourage all parents to talk to their pediatricians if they have questions, so that they can then be ready when the vaccine becomes available. They can be prepared to get the vaccine as soon as it's available in the pediatrician's office. Let me tell you, we are in the process of starting a research trial for the Moderna vaccine, and the word got out, and I've got, tens of, 50, 60 parents contacting me because they want that vaccine for their children. So I think the parents should understand that these vaccines have been thoroughly studied. We have not found it to have caused any serious reaction to Pfizer vaccine. The data that was submitted, no serious side effects from the vaccine were noted. And the vaccines were really 100% efficacious in preventing serious illness in these children. And there is no really reason to expect that these vaccines, all of them, would behave any different in younger children than they have in the adult population where those vaccines are already approved. So the vaccines are safe and they are efficacious. Now, don't forget, there's risk for everything. I always say that. There's risk. When you drive in your car down the street, there's risk. So you can't avoid it. Things can be safer. There's no absolute safety in anything. So, you know, I think this is something that all of us have to understand. But what's more important is that the infection with the virus is much, the harm from that is much worse. So the benefit of the vaccine way outweighs any the harm and the risks the vaccines may have compared to wild-type disease.
We're talking COVID vaccines for kids right now on the show. Pfizer has approved its shot for kids age 12 to 15. What are your thoughts about that? It's 549-2937 as we talk with Dr. Mobeen Rathore at UF College of Medicine. Jax, Paul is on the South Side. Hey, Paul. Good morning.
Good morning. My wife and I know 14 people around the country that unfortunately passed from COVID.
Oh, my, wow. So sorry, Paul.
So once our, thank you. So once our son is able to get it, who's 14, he will he'll get the vaccination because the risks of reactions to the vaccine are far less than you know, the consequences of getting the virus.
Thank you, Paul. And I'm so sorry that you've been touched so closely by the by that many deaths. That's terrible. Dr. Rathore, you know, in the beginning of the pandemic, I remember people saying, I don't know anyone who knows anyone who has gotten the virus. But as it's dragged on, certainly more and more of us know someone who has been sick or has died or, you know, or a friend of a friend. We know of these deaths. It's gotten closer and closer to more and more people, as we heard from Paul.
Yeah, first of all, let me commend Paul for taking steps to protect himself, his family, and by doing that, he's also protecting his community. I think that's another thing that we all need to look at. By getting the vaccine, you not only protect yourself, you protect your community. Melissa, as you know, and I think I mentioned the previous call, that I have lost three friends from medical school from this horrible disease. And I know many family members and friends who got this virus, got very sick, were in the hospital and for sometimes for weeks. So this disease, I think by now, I think that I can't believe that there is anybody who has not been touched by this disease one way or the other. You know, we are seeing, see what's happening in India. You know, we thank God with some of the precautions we took in the United States, and now that there's some vaccinations, we could have been that place. You know, people think it's not possible. No, it is very possible. If we did not take all the measures that were recommended, at least most of us did that, and now if we don't take the vaccine, that could happen. I mean, people could, I mean, I think I'm not trying to exaggerate this. we know what's happening there, and that's something we need to always keep in mind. We should thank God that we averted that sort of a disaster in the United States mm-hmm. by some smart moves recommended by the CDC.
It could have been worse, as crazy as that sounds. And yeah, you know, I mean, my best friend from high school, she died a few months ago of a heart attack. But here's the rub. She had COVID near the beginning of the pandemic, recovered from it, and then months later dropped dead of a heart attack. So her cause of death on her death certificate wasn't listed as COVID, but it was almost certainly a contributing factor.
Yeah, I think that could be. We know that COVID affects the heart. We know that. And that's why, especially in children, there's some data from high school, from college athletes who got COVID and see that it affects their heart. So think about your 4-year-old or a 10-year-old who gets the infection, may not be a very serious infection, and gets healthy, and at 21 years of age has a serious heart problem. Also, don't forget, I always have to remind people, children can also get the dreaded MIS-C disease, which can happen even if your child was totally asymptomatic. In fact, believe it or not, most kids that we have cared for in Jacksonville with MIS-C had no history of that they were actually infected, but when we tested them, we could determine that they have had the infection in the past, and they had often had an epidemiologic link by either being in close proximity with somebody who had COVID-19 or exposure in school or exposure, you know, traveling to an area. So I think we shouldn't forget that, yes, your child may get COVID-19 and you may not know about it. And 4 weeks down the road, they are in the ICU intubated and fighting for their life.
John on the South Side. Hi, John. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Miss Melissa. I got a couple questions. Question number one, when we talk about the kids and the children, how many children have been tested versus the children that we propose to give this to? Number two, when we talk about the vaccine, I'm hearing a lot of, we know that it outweighs the tragedy of catching it and everything, but there is no numbers. He's not giving us any numbers on what has been happening to the children. I mean, it's a lot of talk, like I said last time before. In order for you all to convince American people wholeheartedly, you're going to have to put the evidence up. If you keep talking, you're just talking, because my testimony is this. My family in Miami, five of my family caught the COVID, and all five of my family is alive and well. And I had one of my family that died, which had colon cancer. So in other words, what I'm saying is, how many of the kids that have died or had these adverse effects had underlying problems?
Okay,
like
John.
You made the first thing about your friend.
Let me get him to answer all of your questions. Dr. Rathore.
So first of all, as I said in the beginning, that at least 4 million we know have been confirmed diagnosed with COVID-19.
They're 4 million kids.
Kids, yes. And they're probably more than that. I mean, these are just who were tested, who have some symptoms or some reason to go testing. So I suspect there are a lot more, especially children, because they can be asymptomatic or mildly sick, who had the infection. We know, there are data that these kids who have died. Now, fortunately, a lot of kids don't die of this. Now, we also know that those, as I think John is very appropriately mentioning, those with the underlying health condition, just like you mentioned your best friend, Melissa, they are at a much higher risk. So the risk, if you are obese, that's a risk, high risk factor. If you are have diabetes or other underlying health conditions, you have a higher chance of increased morbidity and even dying of that. This infection and this disease, and there are numbers for that. I mean, I think we can quote numbers there. If you go to the CDC website and other websites, there numbers are plenty in there, which shows that these groups are at a higher risk of dying of these infections. I'm glad that none of John's family members got COVID, did not have serious infections. I'm glad of that. But many of us have the alternate experience. And, of course, I see the sickest of the sickest who are admitted to the hospital with COVID-19. And it's really tragic to see them suffer. So I think those numbers exist. I don't think anybody is doubting
let me ask you this real quickly, and we'll go to a few more calls. Parents routinely vaccinate their children for all kinds of other things.
Right.
And you have to get your child admitted to school unless you file an exemption form. Will this eventually be added to the vaccine schedule for schools, like with measles and diphtheria and polio and all of that?
Well, I hope so. I think right now, because it is an emergency utilization EUA, it's going to be a little tricky to add it to any mandatory immunization. I think once it gets full approval and we'll know and understand more about it, I think there's going to be discussion on that. Right now, it's not mandatory. I know other group, not just the school children, but the healthcare workers. I think there's some discussion it should be mandatory for healthcare workers, just as it is influenza vaccine and measles and varicella, and chickenpox and hepatitis B vaccines are mandatory. I think there's one institution in Texas that has made it mandatory for its leadership and then for all the other employees. So I think you're going to see a movement towards that trend. I think right now what we need to do is get the vaccine out and make sure anybody who wants the vaccine, that includes children, are able to get it. And I think once the vaccine is fully approved, I think those discussions will happen at that time.
Amy in Pontevedra. Hi, Amy. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. My son, he's 13. He is in the Pfizer study for the 12 to 15 age range. He actually received the placebo, but will be getting the actual shot next Wednesday on the 19th.
Mm-hmm.
And my 17-year-old already had the shot. The whole family's in the study.
Wow.
My husband received the actual vaccine back in August of last year, and he still has the antibodies. So we are looking forward to having all four of us vaccinated and actually traveling this summer.
That's great, Amy. And Dr. Rathore, this is the kind of family you're saying we all need to emulate.
Yes, I thank you, Amy. I think being participating in those trials, you really serve not only your country but humanity, so we can get better information on these vaccines. And I think that's great. I think you did, you went above and beyond the call of duty, and I want to thank you not only for myself but on behalf of the rest of us in this country, because had it not been for you and people like you and your family, we would never have these vaccines approved in the EUA. So thank you.
Tweets coming into the show. Emily tweets us, I will get the vax this summer. I wish high schools would make it mandatory so that kids could go to high school and have a normal experience. Brian tweets us, the more people who get vaccinated, the sooner this will be over. Waiting or refusing to vaccinate only prolongs the need for disruptive response measures. One more tweet for you, Doctor. Kids are among the lowest risk group for COVID. They are also a minor vector for disease spread. Why would we leverage an emergency use authorization product on such a low risk group? Your answer.
Well, yeah, first of all, I disagree with that. They are a minor factor in spread. Kids shed the virus for much longer, when we know that. And we know from the study in Korea and other places that they can spread the infection. So I would disagree with that statement on that. Now, to get herd immunity, as I mentioned earlier, if about 30% of your population is children under 19 years of age, and as most people think that you need to get at least 80% immunized, actually I think it's going to be more like 90 to 95% immunized to get to herd immunity. But let's even stay with the number of 80%. And if you don't immunize children, you're never going to get to that 80%. So I think there's a lot of reasons. But most importantly, we know this is a safe vaccine. Now we know that this vaccine is safe in these children. We know that this vaccine is efficacious in these children. If you have a vaccine that is safe and efficacious, you know, why should you not use it? I'll tell you, I think I shared that with you before. My son, who's much older, lives in D.C., and he couldn't get the vaccine in D.C. So I paid for his airfare. He came to Florida. He got his vaccine, his first dose in Jacksonville, and then he flew back, and then they were willing to give him the second dose there. So I think it is if you understand the seriousness of this virus and the seriousness of this disease, and you will go at great lengths to make sure you and your loved one, your family, and you are all protected so they cannot get this illness and get sick and have the serious consequences now or later down the road. So, you know, there is, frankly, in my mind, and there is no reason to consider not immunizing your children or anybody for that matter.
Again, the Pfizer vaccine available now to kids as young as 12. So take the doctor's advice and get your child vaccinated. Dr. Mobeen Rathore, MD, professor of pediatrics at UF College of Medicine, Jacksonville. He's also the associate chair of chief of infectious diseases there. Always great to have you on, doctor. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Keep up the good work. I appreciate it.
Much more still ahead later. Some positive news and notes for your week in our What's Good Wednesdays. But up next.
We had a depleted workforce. We had them responding to the virus with archaic information systems using things like fax machine and Excel spreadsheets rather than modern interoperable information systems.
We'll tell you why a new report says our underfunded public health system in America made the pandemic worse. That's next. Welcome back. Chronic underfunding of America's public health system was a key factor in America's flat-footed response to the pandemic. According to a new report, it examined federal, state, and local public health funding trends and recommends better investment and policy actions to build up our public health system. Also highlighted is the need for public health to be ready to respond to a spectrum of risks, everything from weather-related emergencies to the opioid crisis to even increasing rates of obesity in this country. The report calls for a $4.5 billion annual investment in America's core public health capabilities. For more on this, I spoke with Dara Lieberman, Director of Government Relations at Trust for America's Health. Take a listen. Hi, Dara. Good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is a topic that we've been hearing a lot about lately, so it's good to get some data around it. How the response to COVID-19 was so hampered by the underfunding of the U.S. public health system. It's been a problem forever, but now we've seen in real time just how big of a problem it actually is. How much of a factor was underfunding of public health in the response to the pandemic?
Well, we think that the chronic underfunding of our public health system has had two major impacts during the pandemic. One is that our public health infrastructure and workforce was truly underfunded, and that means that we had a depleted workforce. We had them responding to the virus with archaic information systems, using things like fax machine and Excel spreadsheets rather than modern interoperable information system. The second major problem is that the underlying health of our communities was not as healthy as it could have been had we truly invested in public health and prevention.
Hmm. So what would be some specific examples that you found that you could talk about when it comes to that?
Well, so for example, obesity is another issue that my organization tracks. And it's one of the leading causes of chronic disease. It's one of the leading drivers of healthcare costs in this country. Yet we only have enough funding to support obesity prevention in 16 states. It's truly astounding when you look at the cost of these health crises and the relative return on investment from effective public health and prevention programs. And the two just don't match up.
Mm-hmm.
We also point out that we spend $3.8 trillion on health and healthcare in this country, and only about 2.5% of that goes to public health and prevention.
So we do know that if someone was obese or overweight, they were far more likely to get sick or die from COVID-19. How could public health be better funded in a way to address just that problem alone?
Just that problem alone, we public health has a lot of tools in its toolbox for helping with the obesity crisis. We know it's not just a matter of individual choices, but making the healthy choice the easy choice. So public health does things like work with schools and ensuring that nutritious foods are available, working with hospitals to promote breastfeeding, which we know helps prevent obesity in children, and educating the public on healthy choices. So at making communities more walkable and more accessible for active transportation. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not a silver bullet, but many different policies and programs can help reduce our obesity crisis and make us more resilient for the next disaster.
The COVID pandemic really shone a bright light on this problem, but what you argue in this report is that there is a spectrum of risks, weather-related emergencies, the opioid epidemic. There are other problems that you anticipate where a weak, underfunded public health system will be caught flat-footed more and more. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, we do hope that policymakers learn the lessons of this pandemic, and that is that we just can't fund public health in the middle of a crisis. The metaphor is used a lot, but we don't build firehouses in the middle of a fire. We have to have these systems, workforce, and people in place well ahead of an emergency to become more resilient and to make sure that we're most effectively protecting communities. And we should be spending billions in order to save trillions of dollars that we've spent so far on the COVID response and recovery.
In this report, you look at some numbers of employees. Budgets, personnel are the biggest part of most budgets. And you find that the state and local public health workforce has really been whittled down by nearly 20%. We've seen that in Florida, personnel cuts. So fewer trained professionals to do the work as the pandemic spread. When Congress passed all of the COVID relief money, that didn't necessarily address this problem, did it?
Well, we have seen short-term hiring for activities like contact tracing and for vaccination efforts. And we are hoping that some of that workforce translates into full-time staff.
Mm-hmm.
But we know it's very hard for public health to maintain that workforce if they only have 2 or 3 years of funding. So we call for a sustained investment in public health to be able to maintain that really expert workforce.
Now, at this report, which is at tfah.org for Trust for America's Health, you can break it down by state. Right. So I just clicked on the state profile for Florida, and you find that in Florida, public health outcomes generally lag those of the United States, although the state has taken some steps to strengthen its preparedness for public health emergencies. So sort of a mixed bag for Florida. You give it a score of 6 out of a possible 10. When it comes to measures of public health preparedness for diseases, disasters, and bioterrorism, how could Florida be doing a better job?
So, yeah, you're citing another one of our annual reports called the Ready or Not Report, where we look at how states and the federal government are preparing for emergencies. And Florida certainly has very strong responses to emergencies because there are so many of them. But we...
Our hair is on fire all of the time, basically.
Yeah. So it is well experienced in doing what is necessary to prepare for natural disasters. We also found in this funding report that the state increased its public health budget for the second year. It increased by about 8% in fiscal year 2020. So that is good that they are improving their commitment to public health funding. But we need to see that commitment by lawmakers every year. And we need to make sure that public health has the tools to keep populations healthier in the first place, which is something that every state could be doing a little bit better at.
So at the close of this report, you do have some key findings and then recommendations. What do you recommend that states like Florida and at the national level that we do to better provide resources to public health in America?
Well, prioritizing public health budgets is something that states need to do every year. We do track increases and decreases every year, but that's sort of nibbling around the edges a little bit. We really recommend that Congress pass an annual investment in public health infrastructure and workforce. We find that there's about a $4.5 billion shortfall in our state and local public health department budgets just to invest in the basic foundational capabilities of public health. Having the people, the infrastructure, the labs, the communication systems in place to protect against a range of health threats. That's the number one thing we can do. And we identify major programs and policies that can increase public health funding as well and make sure that we're spending money on effective programs. We also want to make sure that we are investing in CDC's bottom line every year and not just in the middle of an emergency.
Yeah, as you said, it's hard to fix the plane when it's already in midair. So thank you. More at tfah.org. She's Dara Lieberman, Director of Government Relations at Trust for America's Health. Thanks, Dara.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this weekend, historic Springfield is the place to be. Kelly Rich is on the line now. She's executive director at SPAR, that's Springfield Preservation and Revitalization. Kelly, the historic Springfield Tour of Homes and Gardens coming up, which is great to hear. And good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Yeah, we're really excited to be able to bring this back. We had to cancel it in 2020, obviously, which was really disappointing because it was going to be the 42nd year of this continual tradition in historic Springfield. So we're excited to bring it back and have everyone come and see not only our historic architecture, but also the changes that have been happening in Springfield.
And let's talk about that.
Yeah.
What kinds of changes do you think people who maybe they haven't been to the neighborhood in a while that they'll
observe? You know,
it's
interesting. Yeah, it's, we're still kind of dealing with outdated perceptions of the neighborhood. And once we get people here and they see, you know, the renovated homes, the new construction mixed with historic, the business investment, I think that's kind of the biggest surprise for people is to see we've had over 20 small businesses open in the past 3 years. A lot of new restaurants, breweries, shops, all of the artwork that's been incorporated into the public spaces, obviously our park system. There's no shortage of things to do in the neighborhood.
Now, let's talk for a minute about the business piece of this, because in Springfield, you're also doing something this week called UF Health Week, where you're giving discounts at local businesses to healthcare workers. So that's another way that,
This is actually, I think it's like National Hospital Week, so it's a national thing, but UF Health really wanted to do something special for their employees and their neighbors of ours. So we worked with them to kind of embrace them more into Springfield because there's a large, many of their 8,000 employees that obviously just go to work and then go home. And we want them to embrace the community as well. So giving them incentives to come check out the businesses, they're getting discounts. We're making a big hoorah about them coming and spending their week in Springfield. Our goal is to have more U.S. Health badges on Main Street and all of our commercial corridors. So when I reached out to our local business community and asked if they were willing to do any sort of discount or some sort of promotion, every one of them were like, of course. You know, we're very easy and thankful for having them nearby. And so it was a very easy kind of a promotion to put together. And so, like I said, it's been a wonderful partnership, and we're hoping to continue to look for ways to bring new customers to shop our local businesses.
So when people come to the tour of homes Saturday and Sunday, they can do that, and they can also see some amazing homes and gardens. Tell us a little bit more about what they'll see on the tour this year.
Yeah, so this is a home and garden tour. To give a little bit more comfort for those that are, you know, kind of baby-stepping back into in-person events, we're very garden-heavy this year. So we have, I think, only 3 interior spaces. Everything else are backyards and pool houses and things like that. Some beautiful backyards with, you know, historic tree canopy. And I laugh because several of them have been, I guess, recipients of COVID backyard, you know, projects. So everything has been amplified and beautified in the past year. And so we're excited to show it off. We tell people to come to the newly renovated SPAR building at 1321 North Main for that tour check-in. And you'll also get to see our newly renovated building that we've been, that's been empty for the past 3 years. So if you remember, Hurricane Irma knocked us out several in 2017. And so we're really excited to not only put a historic building back into use, but to get us back on Main Street. So that'll be where you'll check in and obviously see our renovated building before you start the tour.
And this guided bicycle tour that you're offering too is free with your ticket. You just bring your bike along and you can go on a guided tour.
Correct. Yes. That's one thing that we love to highlight is how bikeable the neighborhood is. And Lee with Ready to Ride has been doing bike tours for several years. And yes, it's just a bring your own bike, show up. Her goal is to leave on Saturday around 1. And all you have to do is, like I said, just buy a normal ticket and show up and she'll lead you around the neighborhood. In addition to the normal tour stops, she'll bring in and kind of incorporate some other like local history and little tidbits about the neighborhood. So it'll be a wonderful way to enjoy not only the tour, but the neighborhood as a whole.
I think Springfield is a case study in resilience, don't you? Throughout this whole time, it's really remarkable. And I, full disclosure, my family, we live in Springfield, but it's really been remarkable to see how this neighborhood has survived and even thrived in this pandemic.
I agree. It was something that, with all of the excitement and growth from our sesquicentennial in 2019, 2020 was highly disappointing, but we really didn't lose any steam. Several things were just put on pause that are now kind of getting, you know, getting going again. And something I like to say, we didn't lose a single business in 2020. And we actually had like three or four businesses open in the midst of a pandemic. Like, how often does that happen in a little neighborhood?
Right.
So that's something that should show, like you said, the resilience and the adaptiveness that the small business community is garnering and working together, and obviously the support from the city to help make it happen as well.
So with all of that said, is there still time for people to get their early bird tickets for the historic Springfield Tour of Homes and Gardens?
Yes, I tell people to go to springfieldtour.com. The early bird price is only $15, and that'll go until Friday. If you wait and come day of, they'll go up to $20. And what we like to say is the home tour is the only program and event that SPAR offers that's actually, there's a cost involved. If you look at everything else that we provide to the city, everything is free and open to the public. So, you know, we're between Porch Fest, Music on Main, our bike rides, all of that. So, you know, we really try to push for people to come and support this fundraiser for our organization.
Get your tickets now at sparcouncil.org. It's the Historic Springfield Tour of Homes and Gardens this Saturday and Sunday from noon to 5. So much fun. Kelly Rich, Executive Director at SPAR. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Yeah.
And in a moment, some more positive news for you. Everything from Front Row, from Home at the Florida Theater, to Wine, Women, and Shoes, to honoring our healthcare heroes, to even some Comic-Con events coming up at the Mosh. We've got a roundup of fun things you can add to your social calendar as events start coming back. It's all ahead in our What's Good Wednesdays. So keep listening. We'll be right back.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com. Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community, featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at vickerslanding.com. Lee & Kate's Glass, family-owned and operated for 95 years. Lee & Kate's Glass is your source for upgrading your home's glass, from shower doors and mirrors to windows and tabletops. Learn more at leeandkatesglass.com.
Jake Chiobucco here. Join me, WJCT Public Media, and the Florida Theater as I perform live at the WJCT Soundstage on Friday, June 11th, 2021 at 8 p.m. Visit wjct.org/events to purchase tickets. Aloha.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Florida's new voting law restricts absentee voting. Georgia's law gives more power over elections to the Republican-controlled legislature. And Texas is considering a measure to make it harder for voters in urban areas to vote. We'll look at the growing move by Republicans to restrict voting. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
It's another milestone in the nation's battle with COVID-19. The FDA has expanded access to the Pfizer shot, and soon kids as young as 12 will be able to get the vaccine.
Pediatricians across the country are ready and eager to talk to you about the vaccine and answer your questions so that you can feel comfortable vaccinating your child.
Our experts are ready to answer your questions too. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, healthcare workers are amazing people at any time, but throughout this pandemic, their commitment to helping others has shown through in spectacular fashion. Endangering themselves to save sick COVID patients, working incredibly long shifts through a terrifying time, and now vaccinating us by the millions. Let's give a shout out to our healthcare heroes. That's what leads us off this What's Good Wednesday when we bring you a few positive news and notes from the week. Now, as we heard a few moments ago, Springfield is honoring healthcare heroes with their UF Health Week. UF Health is the third largest employer in the city, and SPAR wants to introduce hospital employees to the unique businesses in the Springfield Historic District. More than a dozen of them are offering discounts and incentives this week to UF Health employees. Check it all out at sparcouncil.org. And the First Coast is getting some love from the Florida Blue Foundation. Their annual statewide Sapphire Awards recognize organizations and individuals in the healthcare field. Three honorees this year hail from Jacksonville. So hearty congratulations to these standouts, beginning with Dr. Jeffrey Goldhagen, Medical Director at the Partnership for Child Health. He's also affiliated at UF Health. He wins a $60,000 award with the focus area of mental well-being. UF Health Jacksonville also wins $60,000, their focus area, health equity. And Ability Housing got a Sapphire Award, also on health equity. Shannon Nasworth, their leader, accepted $50,000. So congrats to the winners. Well, a very fun event, Wine, Women, and Shoes, is coming up this week. This year, the excitement is all virtual. I spoke about it with Lauren Hopkins at Episcopal Children's Services.
It's going to be a lot of fun. So we've got silent auction, a live auction, submission moments. We have a chance to win a key to the closet, which is a full spa day valued at $1,500. We also have a wall of wine. So we had 60 bottles of wine donated.
This is always a great event. You can start bidding on items right now. Go to winewomenandshoes.com/jax. Well, cosplayers rejoice. The Museum of Science and History, the MOSH, announced two Comic-Con events coming to their museum this month in celebration of Stage 9 exhibits Toytopia and the Lost World of Dragons exhibitions. MOSH is bringing Playworld Mini Comic-Con and Ren Faire Mini Medieval Con this May. Get your tickets at themosh.org. And here is another virtual event that caught our eye this week. It's Front Row from Home at the Florida Theater. You can watch some amazing performances at the Florida Theater from the comfort of your couch. CEO Numa Sasselin gave me a preview of this.
About this time of year, every year, the Florida Theater has its annual benefit, which is typically a giant dance party blowout. Which for obvious reasons is not something we want to do this year. So
right. This
Thursday night, May 13th at 7:30, we're having our very, very first virtual online fundraiser called Front Row from Home. It's a one-hour streaming broadcast with five local bands hosted by Ken Amaro, Steve Smith, and Catalina Salvain, and guest appearances by a bunch of bold-faced name artists who have been on the Florida Theater stage, including 38 Special and Judy Collins, Dave Koz, Brian Regan, Mindy Abair, and others.
Log on tomorrow night and check out all the fun at frontrowfromhome.com. It'll stream on YouTube, and this is an easy way that you can support a local gem, the Florida Theater. Finally, don't miss Friday's show. We'll hear all about A Brush with Nature. That's the much-loved annual event that is coming back this year and taking place at another of the city's gems, the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens. This is a plein air painting event where you walk through beautiful gardens and see local artists painting the landscape. And the paintings, of course, are available for purchase. It's a highlight of the spring social calendar. And this year, it will be particularly delightful. That's coming up Friday. For more good news delivered straight to your inbox, sign up for our What's Good Wednesdays weekly newsletter at wjctnews.org. And if you have an item you'd like us to add to our weekly menu, just drop us a line and let us know about it. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. You can send those emails, as I mentioned, to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, well, our podcast will be up later today, wherever you like to listen. You can also download the WJCT app and listen to this show and a lot of other great content right through the app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Wednesday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.